Welcome to the Dork Forest. Jackie and her pals will never bore us. Shameless confessions
about our obsessions
will make us laugh and smile. So let's explore the Dork Forest and dork out for a while.
Hi, Jackie Cation here. You're listening to The Dork Forest. You know the websites, dorkforest.com, thedorkforest.com, if you like a determiner. JackieCation.com has everything. Both of my podcasts, all of the stand-up stuff, the new album, links to YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, all the things. But so, I think, does dorkforest.com, where you can look at old videos of different shows. Anyway, if you want to support the show, tell people about the show, review it on iTunes, thumbs it up on Pandora or Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts, I appreciate that. You can donate. You can donate monthly. PayPal lets you do that. You can also do my Venmo if you like. It's at Jackie Cation absolutely everywhere. And my email address is jackie@jackiecation.com. And that's what the PayPal is. The PayPal link is on jackiecation.com and dorkforest.com. And go to any of them. Thanks for listening. There's merch. There's stand-up. There's tour guide. You know, you can find out where I'm touring. This is getting long, so let's get into the show.
Hey, Jackie Cation, I'm in my living room. Spider-Man, right? Uh-oh, that way. There he is. And I am with Andrea Jones-Roy. Andrea Jones-Roy has her own website called Majoring in Everything, which has a very Dork Forest vibe to it, as far as I can, because I'm sure people can talk about anything, right, Andrea?
Exactly.
Jones-Roy. Yeah. And by the way, on TikTok, Twitter, Instagram, all the things, it's Jones-Roy, but two O's, JonesRoy. And it's jonesroy.com. This will all be in the notes. Majoring in Everything, also in the notes. So Majoring in Everything, yeah, so it has that vibe to it?
Yes, yes. And sometimes, this is how scattered I am. Sometimes even now I'm like, is that the right topic? Should I have done something else? And it's like, I can literally talk about whatever I want. And yet I still feel constrained. So That's for me and my therapist to work through, but that's where I'm feeling.
Do you have guests on Majoring in Everything?
Yes. So the conceit of the show is I could never pick a thing to focus on because I love a variety of things. And so it's trying to talk to other people who also have a million different interests that are seemingly unrelated and how they make sense of their lives and what they've done and whether they fit them together or do it separately.
Right.
I feel like you'd be a good fit for the show if you'd like to come on.
Oh, sure. Yeah. It's the main difference is that there is no expertise on the Dork Forest. There can be, and there definitely is a celebration of minutia. But
yes,
let me say that enthusiasm often trumps expertise, and who doesn't love to yell at their device while they're listening to a show going, you actually got that wrong. You got that wrong. I said that Joe Rogan was on Frasier. He was on News Radio.
I see. Yeah.
Big swap, big switch.
Try to live
problem.
That down. Trump. Yeah. The internet's very mad.
And the turns out, I am making errors all the time. So, if someone can't pick a specific thing for me to live down, it is a broad and varied choice of things that I've been wrong about. There are buildings full of things
I
don't know.
Yeah. I try to avoid facts at all costs. just to, I'm not lying to anyone, but I'm not going to state anything that's like, you could look up.
Interesting.
Sort of my
because
strategy.
one of your dorkdoms or the main was data science.
That's right.
Which sounds like a celebration of spreadsheets.
It is a celebration of spreadsheets, and I might use that as the tagline for my course when I teach it next semester.
Please do. It's people love it.
Yeah, like in curly writing, like, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Jones-Roy cordially invite you to a celebration of spreadsheets. And they're like, who? Isn't it just one person? They're like, don't worry about it. I'm going to hang up on it. It is a salvation of spreadsheets. But the thing is, and people think, oh, if you're a data scientist, you must be good at like trivia, Jeopardy, and you must just know all the facts. Because what is data if not a collection of facts? The problem is, I don't know any individual data points. I sort of look at them all in aggregate. So
okay.
I can tell you, that went up over time, but I can't tell you like who the president was in most years of human history.
Right, right. And certainly not before 1776, but
exactly.
Or 82. It
well,
would
maybe
be 82.
We could both kill it on that front.
Wait, like, right now, nah. But before then, and what does it mean then? So it's a celebration. You have information, and you like to collect it.
Yes.
About a variety of things.
Yes. What? But never look at it too closely, right? You're looking at, we're thinking scatter plots, we're thinking trend lines, you know, okay. Very, very high levels.
What are you working on right now? Like, what's open now? If you were to look at your laptop and see an Excel, yes. Excel is open and you're like, oh, look. What's corn production in Wisconsin like?
Yeah, I could probably find that out for you, but I currently have two things going on. One is I do a lot of research for companies who work in, I'm putting this in heavy air quotes, people analytics, because there's a lot of problems with that term, but it's basically like data about people at work. So the dreaded, I don't know if you are a corporate person or have done the 9-to-5 business, I don't know, I feel like it's in the middle of the afternoon and we're doing a podcast, so maybe not, but... any of your listeners who are, you know, if you take an engagement survey and you're like, this sucks, this is the worst thing I've ever done and no one's listening to this and the data is terrible, I go into companies and I help them either make sense of it or do a better job of asking those sorts of questions and like doing analyses. But I also am like, happen to be launching a project that I don't know where your listener base stands on this or where you stand on this, but I am very intrigued by the gun control debate. Intrigued is an interesting word. Depressed, furious, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
Terrified, like, all too, these things. Yes.
Yeah, too positive. But I have gone down the rabbit hole of looking at a lot of conservative, big shock in Lower Manhattan, here I am being liberal, but a lot of conservative data around gun control where they insist that guns make everyone safer. And I'm just like, I don't think that can be the case. So I'm like about to launch like a whole weekend project of going through gun data is okay. What I'm probably going to do.
Okay. Yeah. So what is an analytics survey that someone might get at their work?
So you'd get a survey like once a year, or some companies do it twice a year, where you say, you know, they're usually super long and tedious and not good. And it's like 50 questions where it's like, I feel like I can bring my authentic self to work every day. Somewhat strongly disagree, wow. Somewhat disagree, but like 5 choices, right? I believe my manager has my career interests at heart. I would recommend working at this company to a friend. That kind of stuff.
It's like when at the end of the call at Delta, between 1 to 5, would you hire this person for?
Yes.
Okay.
I love that you mentioned that, because I use that example when I talk to clients and companies as an example, and it's a pretty dumb survey, but it's actually way better than what they do. And I say, think about what Delta's doing. Try that.
Right. It's super
one question. It's to the point. Yeah.
And it's over.
Yeah.
And you want to be supportive. And if it's and they probably only get a bump or a bonus if it's always a 5.
Right.
And so it's amazing to me that there are analytics surveys where they want to know, is this the best thing in your life? You work at this job. And you're like,
yeah,
it isn't.
Yeah.
It is.
And then they freak out.
They freak out because you're like, yeah, but I'm an insurance adjuster. Or I answer the phones at a captioning company, which was my last.
Oh, wow. I was like, that is specific.
Right. My last day job was I was the traffic person. And all that means is I signed things and out. In and out. And also sort of there was a lot of catch-all to it because there wasn't really, so it was kind of admin, secretarial, go make some coffee, you know, this type, you know, do whatever is needed. But it was called the traffic person because there was a lot of sort of data that needed to be, and then I would answer the phones. And when I quit that job, and I liked that job, the people I worked with were very nice. It was almost idiot-proof in the fact that I didn't have to do a lot of commitment intellectually or emotionally to the job. I just had to make sure it was a little bit of juggling, but it certainly wasn't – like I do stand-up comedy, right? So creatively, it did not suck. It wasn't a sales position.
Yes.
So it didn't take a lot of that energy from me.
Yes.
But when I quit that job, I used to have – and it still happens, but I did not know it was a permanent fixture when I had that job, what I call my Asperger's hump, which is a shooting pain in my back where I am socially unhappy. I am not pleased. So when I quit that job, my whole body sort of got relaxed.
Wow.
Which I don't think – so I don't think anyone even – and this was a job I liked.
Yeah. As you were saying that, I was like, I got to quit them all. I'm so tense. Yeah. Well, and the thing is that it's the whole exercise sucks, really. And I'm going to lose all my jobs now for saying this, but I mean it.
But there is like, there might be a way to fix it. I don't know.
Right. So one, you could ask better questions, which is one thing that I advise people on. So I did a lot of survey research in grad school and like that sort of stuff. So it's like, there are ways to ask questions that you make exactly as you said, you sound like you're trying to find out, is this the most important thing in your life? Would you literally like leave your husband if we asked you to? And you're like, yes, thank you. You know, and I'd be pleased to do it.
I wanted, and is there another 75 cents an hour? Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Will there be Nutri-Grain bars for free some Fridays? You know, whatever. Done. So it's like, you could do it where it's like, do you feel that you're respected or what, blah, blah, blah. And like, it sounds like, you know, questions that would tap into like, is this generally a pleasant experience for you? Right. So they ask these extreme questions. Then they freak out if the numbers aren't 100% or if they've gone down. And then they, sometimes I come in another capacity to do like more heavy air quotes, focus groups, where I sit with them and I say, I'm an external consultant. What do you want me to tell your leadership about what would make life better at the company?
Right.
And they will tell me things that are really meaningful and powerful. Like the leadership doesn't seem to have any empathy. They don't really seem to care about what we're going through. They don't realize that it's like tough to find a place to live in this city. They don't respect us to manage our own time, blah, 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 blah. Really good stuff. I shouldn't say blah, blah, blah. And then I'll go to the leaders and say, well, this is what they said. And they say, a second coffee machine. Okay, here, we hear you. And you're like, oh my God.
Right. So.
And if it goes up, if engagement goes up, not too much as thing is too much minutiae. There's too much minutiae right here. But if the engagement results go up, they all high five each other and say, everyone's more engaged. We're doing it. But probably all the miserable people quit since you last did the survey.
Right, right. And I will say this is my sister was sitting with her boss and a lateral VP dude, and they were congratulating themselves on the diversity in their company, these two white guys. And and my sister is gay and has a darker complexion than me because she's more Armenian looking. Mm. And she's like, I'm your diversity. This is you have to either stop congratulating yourself or literally hire some more people.
Yeah.
Because this conversation is I'm going to cut myself. And they were like, what do you mean? We hired that guy from Pakistan. And she's like, he's from India and you are out of your minds. Yeah. So,
I've done that too. I've done the diversity survey thing where they just, you know, the categories are problematic. They reinforce it. Just the whole thing's a mess. But I also have had a similar conversation. One of my first consulting jobs where I sat with like this fancy C-suite people who are all congratulating themselves. And they say, well, here in our C-suite, we have people of color. We have women. And it turned out it was one woman of color.
Yes.
Was it.
Yes.
And it's like, you don't get to tick two boxes. Like intersectionality is a whole thing, but like you don't get to give yourself two stars.
Yes.
For this.
And the other thing that my husband has a podcast called Ethics and Video Games because he makes video games and his buddy is a philosophy professor.
Oh,
and he has lost two jobs because one of the questions in interviews he's asked is, what are your ethics? And they're like, oh, we don't want to actually work with you. So, but the thing is one of the women, one of the professors that they interviewed she doesn't use the word. And I just remembered this, is she doesn't use the word diversity. She uses the word homogeneity. And she's like, what we're looking for is we're trying to get away from homogeneity.
Mm.
We just want it. We don't want it to be all men. We don't necessarily want it to be all women. We don't want it to be all people of color. We don't want it to be all black or all white. We want it to be because that literally that diversity will make for more information and more it sells more tickets. It's sort of like a stand-up comedy. If you book all straight white guys, a lot of straight white guys, they're already coming. But if you book an Asian woman, the Asian community in that town, even if it's that specific, you know, if it's just the Korean community, is like, what's happening? There's a Korean comic. More women will come. Everyone has jobs. Money can be spent.
And it makes a better show because I do stand-up comedy as well. And I will be, you know, the token non-man on a lineup. And the
Andrea,
good news is
I didn't know you did stand up. You do stand up in New York?
Yeah, I do. I didn't mention it in my list. I almost did in my list of like minutiae that I could get into, but I was like, oh, I'm sure you talk to nothing but stand-up comedians. Right. And so I figured you knew that. But
stand-up
yeah.
is hard on the Dork Forest, but it's always nice to plug the fact yeah. that you guys should go see Andrea Jones-Roy do stand-up comedy.
There you go.
Because
yes.
that is an exciting. And plus,
you can see me up against a lineup of dudes.
Right. You can see, right. Yeah. We could all shine in that situation.
Exactly.
And, I have another podcast, The Jackie and Laurie Show, where we're always yeah. looking for comics of the week who all happen to be women. They just happen to be
hey.
Women. Laurie Kilmartin yeah. and I just happen to, we've had, you know, we had several hundred episodes. We just haven't found a funny dude. Not that men aren't funny. They're plenty funny. But the
some can be funny if you're like willing to listen, you know,
yeah,
but
exactly.
Yeah, it's just not for me.
It's not real. They're usually not talking to me. So yeah. no, I'm kidding. But the, or am I? But here's the scoop about the analytics thing is, do you ever think about that scene in Mad Men where he sells the slide projector, the carousel slide projector, and he sells it as nostalgia?
Yes.
He doesn't sell it as anything but.
Yes.
And so putting those questions feel like those kind of questions where you're not really, they're not necessarily going to help the workplace to have these kind of questions.
Yes. No, I'm so glad you mentioned Mad Men because I literally like watched that scene somewhat recently because I wanted to reference it for something. But where I thought you were going was the scene, maybe it's the same episode, I'm not sure, where he, I don't think so, where the person who leads the focus groups and is the analytics person comes in and is like, I'm going to ask the women what kind of lipstick they want. And then what they tell me is going to be what I produce. And Don Draper is like, no, we have ideas. We tell people what they want and we sell it to them and we promise a better life or we sell them nostalgia and all these things. Mm-hmm. And honestly, for all my time in analytics, I mean, his sales, it's all kind of, you know, crap and capitalist and evil, but he's onto something. And I think my companies that I work with forget that we should start with ideas when we think about data. Instead, they say, let's just throw 500 questions at these people and look for the, quote, insight that will tell us what to do, which is get a second coffee machine. Whereas it's like, if someone in the C-suite paused to think for one second, like, why might someone not like working here? Why might someone who is a member of a minority group find it difficult to work in this environment? What is it that we're doing? And if you just thought for a second, you could generate much more thoughtful survey questions. You would look at the data you have with fresh eyes, and you just don't see any of it.
How about this? Here's a yeah. question I would like to ask everyone's workplace, right. which is, does everyone know that they're at work?
Ooh.
Does everyone know that this is not, like, it's not that it can't be fun or it can't be right. interesting. It's just, do they know that this is not their, these are not their family members. They cannot
right.
make fun of someone's weight. They don't,
right.
there's no place here for your weird racist or sexist joke.
Yes.
There doesn't mean that there can't, you know, it doesn't mean that you have to be a sad sack or that it's going to be super glum to work here. But
right.
does everyone know that they are in a workplace
yeah.
first? And so tasks must be done. I yeah. used to assistant manage a hot dog stand. And
huh.
I would tell the kids that were in charge of filling the sodas. They were like 14, 15 years old. It was a resort. And I was like, you guys, you can screw around. You can even like horseplay. I don't even care as long as you stay out of the way. And all of the sodas get filled in a timely fashion.
Yeah.
And the ketchup gets mopped up as soon as it gets stripped. And
yeah.
You run
a tight ship at that hot dog stand.
You got to run a tight ship when you're running a hot dog stand at Cape Cod. And
yeah.
they
don't mess around over there. Famous for their hot dog stands. Very tidy stands.
They're
yeah.
charging you $4 or $5 for a hot dog. You better yeah. at least get it quickly. And it should be hot.
Prisons are more relaxed. Yeah.
great loss to the Austrian army. So that's interesting. So you try to sort of direct that sort of interesting. One of the things you said was that political science wasn't political science. What do you mean by that? That was one of the data science things that you were talking about.
So political science is I got my PhD in political science. I have since morphed to data science because I was always like very interdisciplinary. And so I was basically doing the same thing just with, I was very quantitative. So like like polling data, survey data, voting data, international conflict data, trade data, all that stuff that you might imagine as a political data sets. I was doing like statistics and machine learning with, and so I've switched to data science because I'm just interested in lots of other things. And so at workplace data, this gun stuff that I'm going to have a cheerful weekend digging through. It's so depressing. Or basically I'm just like, these people can't be right. What am I missing in the data that I'm going to, I think they're anyway. So the political science is much more scientific than it sounds. And I'm going to sound very defensive because I got one thing that helped when I switched from political science to data science. Literally my job didn't change. My work didn't change. My skills didn't change. But everyone, I walk into a room and I say, hi, I'm a data scientist. And they say, oh my gosh, I could never do that. That's so amazing. What's it like? How can I learn?
What is it all? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And then and what are the insights, actionable insights, right? And then if I say, hi, I'm Andrea, I'm a political scientist, they'll say either political science is not a science, or they'll say, like, what do you think about, you know, the redistricting in Illinois? And you're like, I've never heard of it. I don't know, follow these races, you know? And so they think you're like a pundit or a wonk or like a,
right,
you
a
just
talking
write op-eds.
Head. Right, right.
Yeah.
Right. It's more of a talking head kind of, like, I have a degree, BA, 2.87. Hold your applause. GPA.
Nice. But the I respect that. You actually have to go out of your way for that.
Right. You have to almost not care. But there was a choice between poli-sci or history when I went to they said I had to pick a major. Yeah. So I said, how's it look? And they said, you have one more credit towards graduation in poli-sci than you do in history. And I said, well, then I am a poli-sci major.
That's the kind of dedication we want in this field. That's
exactly
right.
But this there. But at the undergraduate level, there doesn't seem to be a lot of science. It does seem to be more history and opinion and theory and politics rather than science.
Right. I did political science in undergrad, it was the same. It was like, let's spend 3 weeks learning about the government in Japan. I can't even remember. It's called the Diet, or is that Germany? I don't know. Right.
Okay.
And then the government in Germany. And then we'll talk about Congress and how Billikum becomes a law and like all that kind of crap. And so I went to grad school thinking I really liked international relations and the big picture things about like Morgenthau and Kissinger and like the fundamental nature of war and all this kind of philosophy stuff that you and your husband probably know about. And I got to grad school and they're like, nah, we're a quantitative program. You're going to learn statistics and game theory, which is like mathematical modeling. And I hated it for a few years. And then my brain broke and I was like, oh, I see why this is cool. And I've been very into it ever since. But I forget, I'm so glad you said that, because I forget that at the undergrad level, when we take political science, we're literally, it's like you're reading the newspaper, basically.
Right. It's more of a debate class than anything else.
Yes.
And there's the history of the founding of nations. And there's whether that is domestic or international.
Yeah.
It is more relations than science.
Yeah. Exactly.
So that is fascinating because one of my brothers, who's an econ professor, he has an undergrad in poli-sci, and then got his master's in urban development and he got his PhD in economics.
Very cool.
And so he has been on this show. His dorkdom was Hallmark Christmas movies, and he showed us his spreadsheets because it was.
I want to see that spreadsheet. That's so good.
Yeah, feel free to look up the Ruskation episode of the Dork Forest from two Christmases ago. And
a holiday miracle.
A holiday. Back to back episodes. Jen Kirkman did the other Hallmark Christmas, and she did not have any spreadsheets. She had favorite episodes.
I think if you're not putting something in a spreadsheet, I don't know how you live your life. Like, if it matters to me, it's in a spreadsheet. I have spreadsheets for anyway. Yes.
Do you have spreadsheets? So, Andy also enjoys a spreadsheet. He will. He likes to see the data. He likes to see it over a course of time. Have I made the right decision? This is an interesting way to decide whether you've made the right decision because it isn't quantitative in any other measurable way.
Right.
Like the way I decide if I've made a good decision is, do I still live indoors? Right. I mean, do I have work in June? And, but what?
Yeah. Like, have I stolen this food that I'm relying on to stay alive?
Right. It was the last time I shoplifted. It's been a long time. I win. Right. I win.
You put up a little sign like, it's been this many days since I had to steal to stay alive. I did something similar I did a game theoretical analysis. Actually, it was decision theoretical analysis to figure out if I should quit my job.
Okay.
5-6 years ago. It was my first academic job. I left academia for a while and went back. And decision theory, your economist brother will love this, is basically saying, like, you draw a little graph and you say, here's me, this dot, and here are my options. I could quit my job. I could go part-time. I could take a year leave. I could quit forever. And I was like, all I need to do is write out some equations characterizing what my payoffs will be in each of these scenarios, and then it will be obvious what the optimal choice is. And I was writing it out, and I'm writing it out. I have a picture I can like show you, because I eventually had so many variables, and it was just infinity unknowns that I was like, this can't be done. This is, I don't know. Am I going to get another job? I don't know. How can I put that into an equation? Right. So it didn't work. Led me to quit, but.
Right. But it does, like, at least you put it, when you put stuff down on paper, it does make it clearer.
Yes.
Like, you do sort of, there are people who do those pro-con lists.
Yes.
Like, is it helpful? Is it not helpful? And I think that once you start writing down, like, what you want out of things, a lot of people, like, when they go to find an apartment or to find a place to live or a city or to buy a house or to look for a boyfriend. When I went to look for a boyfriend online, because that's where you do your shopping.
That's where you do it. Yeah.
And so online dating, a friend of mine.
Amazon should just buy Tinder. Have they? That's
I would not
that
be surprised.
Happened.
And and so, oh my God, if Bezos bought Tinder.
I know. Actually, as I said it, I was like, by should, I mean should not. But I think.
Right.
You're right. It's probably already happened.
I have a mythical romance novel in my mind where Elon Musk, it's Elon Musk.
Yeah.
It's Elon Musk and J.K. Rowling fall in love and both become better people.
The world needs that.
The
Get
world
it out.
Needs
Get it
that.
Out.
And if I could just send them both a copy. So hint, hint, nudge, nudge. Don't die on that hill. So why would you? Okay. So the writing of lists can make, and the making of spreadsheets, even the task itself can drive you to see what you like about different things.
Yes. I've done that to students as an exercise. I'll say, all right, you're interested in, so I'm going to get fired for this too, but I thought students were interested in things like economic inequality and happiness and democracy. And it turns out they're interested in like increasing value for shareholders. I think I just have too many business students, but either way, I'll say, imagine your ideal data set for a thing you care about in the world. And just the act of being like, well, what would the rows be? What would the columns be? Even if you don't have that data,
right,
can help you be like, right, this is actually what I
this need. Is yeah, this is what I need. Yeah. This is what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
And it's sort of a way to stop future tripping about the future, because it makes you look at it in the present while still acknowledging what you want in the future. And
I almost want to start a spreadsheet behind this just to keep track of this conversation, because that's, I mean, luckily we're recording it, but it's a very good advice.
Right. Well, I think it has, I mean, that it's like, I can never even remember how to add in Excel. So that's not my, but writing things down is something that I do a fair amount of. And I can see how that doing an Excel spreadsheet, doing a spreadsheet about stuff would also be kind of healing and a good tool.
Yes.
For even life. And so
it's kind of like it's a way that I like channel all the scary uncertainties and complexities and contradictions in life. Is like, one of the things I like about data science and I like about political science is that politics is just like the messiest, stickiest, goriest, most horrible stuff you can think about, I think, among the worst things you can think about. But if you at least have, like, here are the numbers of, like, what people are doing with respect to this issue. And, like, I feel better even just mentioning it, you know? It's like,
right.
I don't know what you do with that, but it just makes me feel better.
Well, I think it takes you out of the mire of humanity. And because the humans are the ones that are sticky, right? They're the ones that are...
We're very sticky.
We're just full of goo. And
disgusting.
And the people that choose, and the wheeling dealing that happens in the trenches of stand-up comedy. Ooh, Freudian.
Well,
Freudian slip.
Yeah.
And if you could separate yourself from it, you know, like there are decisions. A woman interviewed me about the pay of features currently on the road. There's, you know, there's an MC, there's feature, there's a headliner. Feature pay has not gone up. Matter of fact, it has gone down because they've taken away lodging. for Beecher's on the Road. Wow. When I first started, you would get probably $100 a night, which might be $50 a show, but it might be $100 a show, depending on how many shows in the night. But you would get a hotel room, and it would be at a Best Western. It would be at a Super 8. It wouldn't be a fancy hotel room, but you wouldn't have to sleep in your car. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't have to figure out who you knew in that area that you could crash at, or you wouldn't have to lose money. You would probably still just break even and eat a lot of chicken wings, but it would be it would be a livable, horrible, livable wage. And she asked me about this, and I was like, well, I don't feature, but from what I see on the road, it's not good, and it isn't fair. And so I told her what I knew of it and how I tried to troubleshoot it if I could. And she only asked Maria Bamford was the only other. She like only asked like three comics and and one of them wasn't a comic. One of them was a guy who worked for Rick Bronson's club. And so he was kind of defending it. And I was like, would you please ask a bunch of middle-aged white dudes what they're doing about it? And in addition to asking, because I'm constantly having to talk about losing work, but I it's like I have to talk about the injustices that are either happening laterally, have happened to me, or have happened laterally or beneath me, and I'm trying to stick up for people.
Yeah,
but they're not asking sort of the right people these questions, because so the data coming in isn't really going to make a difference, because it's all just going to sound like hysterical, strident girl talk, which is too bad, because it's not like there aren't men who have those, who have good opinions, right? Who have a sense of justice and who know when they see shitty things happening and who, and who pay fair, who do the same thing Maria does, which is try to bump pay. They interviewed Margaret. She interviewed Margaret Cho as well, but she didn't interview like Brian Regan pays super fair. Cat Williams pays super fair. Ron Funches pays super fair. Other comics who I don't want to mention because I don't need the bullshit, which is a pity. Because I would like.
Well, it sounds like, like not a representative sample to start.
There we go. That's what it isn't in spreadsheet talk.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it reminds me of when we do these surveys at companies, whether it's about like diversity, inclusion, belonging, equity, or more engagement, generic stuff. And then you hear from people who say, well, it tends to be, you know, Black employees or women or LGBTQIA folks who have the lowest engagement ratings or the most like strong commentary when it's like, here's what's going on. And it's usually really thoughtful and important stuff. But then they're just pinned as like, oh, well, they're just being difficult. They complain. They do this. They do that. And so it's like, if you point out the inequity or the injustice, you're seen as part of the problem when it's like, no, we brought you in because we believed that diversity was valuable, that we want less homogeneity. We brought you into homogeneous culture. You found this homogeneous culture unwelcoming and difficult. And now you're pointing that out, which is what we brought you in. One of the many things we brought you in the hopes of changing. And we're telling you that you're difficult.
Like, right. It just,
that sounds like what you're describing in comedy too.
That's exactly what that is. Cause you, that, yes. Yeah. And it's so weird because you're trying to, and I think that anti-homogeneity thing might help better than a diverse, than asking for diversity because it might be easier to understand because everyone knows that we're all in our own fishbowl and we're swimming around our own castle. And you're like, well, my castle isn't that great, but there are people who don't have castles and you can't see out of your own fishbowl because of the distortion of the water. That's my analogy.
That's very good analogy. Right. Yeah. I'm right there with you. Yeah.
Right. But it's so it would be nice. So people who need to see these spreadsheets, you know, sort of need some pros to go with it.
Yeah.
It's hard to explain this stuff via spreadsheet, maybe.
Right. Well, that's one of the other things I'm always harping about. I actually did a presentation this morning for a bunch of people who were like, we didn't ask for this. And it was just me ranting. Like, I was just like, I'm like, and another thing about like what people get wrong about data science. And it was like, I don't even know who these people were. I think they were in insurance. I'm not, but I just show up and they speak about this.
I just want a ringtone. It's like, we didn't ask for this.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, they're like, it was like 8 a.m. and they're like, whoa, like this is like, I just kind of came out of the gates just being like, here's what everyone's got wrong about data science. And I never once asked them what they thought data science was. I was just like, I got a lot of problems with you people. And I don't even know you. But one of the things I was saying and say all the time is that people say stuff like, what does the data say? The data speaks for itself. And it's like, nah, man, it doesn't do any of those things. It's numbers in a spreadsheet. And humans look at those numbers and we say, oh, they're going up. They're going up in such a way that it's interesting. They're going up faster than I thought it would. Here's what we should do about it. Like, humans interpret that. So the fact that you said, you know, you need prose, you need words to make sense of data. And I saw something once. It was like every data set tells a story. Like, no, it does not. Humans tell stories with data.
Right. And the interpretation, I don't know if you could change column headers. Is there a way you could change the word with the column header?
You sure can. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
that's one of the great joys of data science is changing the column names.
Right. The column names. That's where most of the writing happens, I bet.
Yeah. But even that actually, I mean, it's kind of a funny example, but it's actually very meaningful. So I'll give you an example, which is I do a data set with my students that I like from something called the World Happiness Report. And it's like there's a column in this. It's like different countries and there's various other things like GDP per capita and lifespan and blah, blah, blah. And then there's this score for average self-reported happiness in the country. And we write in the data set, the variable is just called happiness. And it's on a scale from 1 to 10. But if you look at the documentation, and you know we're in a good podcast when we're talking documentation, right? But when you look at the documentation for the data, it says, well, actually what we do is we go around and we ask people in different countries, picture your life as being on a ladder where one, the first rung is your worst possible life and 10 is your best possible life. And where are you on this life ladder? And you say, oh, I'm a 6, I'm a 4, I'm a 5. And like, you know, Afghanistan is always the lowest and Denmark is always the highest. And like, it's all very depressing, right? Yeah. But if you look at the data set and all you know is it's happiness, you think, oh, that's just happiness. But if you were to change that variable name to life ladder or ladder, it would remind you that all you're really doing is answering one very, very specific sort of question that people might interpret in different ways. I don't know. Maybe there are cultures where ladders are bad luck. And so you're just like, I abstain. You know, whatever. That's a kind of a silly example.
But no.
But renaming the column to reflect what's actually in the data is like very valuable.
That makes so much sense. Wow.
You know, or they'll do something like wealth. But really what you mean is GDP per capita, which is very different from the wealth of a country, depending on how you're measuring wealth or personal wealth. And it's just your income and it doesn't include the mansion you own in, you know, Cape Cod with the hot dog stand proceeds or whatever.
Right. You're just like net versus gross. And right.
You got to get out there and rename your variables. That's
rename
takeaway.
Your variables, people. You have a new album. It's your album
there
title.
It is. Yeah. Yeah.
Please name your next album, rename your variables.
I'm going to get my act together to make an album just so I can call it Rename Your Variables.
Right. It's that is fascinating. Where have you seen this data actually used correctly or incorrectly? Got anecdotes about data?
Mm.
You know what I mean? Anecdotal evidence of
constantly. Yes. Yeah. I've got a lot of data anecdotes is another fun thing to think about. I don't know who to hate on first. One study that really bothered me. I use this as an example in my classes. I worked for 538 for like a year and a half.
Okay.
The Nate Silver predict the world with numbers kind of thing. And it wasn't the best place I've ever worked.
Yeah.
We never did an engagement survey, so I didn't get to tell them that. But
Exit interview?
No exit interviews. No, nothing.
We don't need to know. Just don't let the door hit you. Okay.
Yeah. It was even worse than that. It was like I was part-time and I hit the maximum. This is so boring, but I hit the maximum number of hours for a certain period. And so I was like, all right, I better like not work or else you'll have to start giving me health insurance, perish forbid. And so we agreed like I'd take September off. And then in the meantime, my manager, my editor quit. And so I didn't really have an editor. And so then no one emailed me to be like, do you want to come back? And in the meantime, I'd gotten another job. And I eventually emailed them to say, hey, I think I don't work here anymore. Like, bye. You know, in January, they never replied. And then for like a year and a half, I got paid every federal holiday. It was awesome.
I'll take that as a parting gift. Thank you.
Yeah. I also kept their computer. They just never, it was so disorganized that like, I just disappeared into the wallpaper. Like, it was so weird.
Right. It was that is...
And you this know, is data people, right? These are the people who should know who's in there. And it's only 30 employees at the time. It's like, I'm right there in the spreadsheet, but I'm not. So my story for them is we did a survey that I helped them write, and it was very bad on what it was around the Me Too, height of Me Too stuff. And it was, what does it mean to be a man in America today? And we did a survey where we asked, like, your reaction is the right one. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. It's like, and the fact that that was like, they were like, what's the interesting story in Me Too?
What's the angle?
How are men feeling about being a man? Let's probe there. You're just like, oh, this is so problematic. We did the survey, and I like tried to help them design it. It was not very good. You know, it was like, to what extent is your physical appearance part of your identity as a man? To what extent is your community part of your identity? What? It's just not good. You can find the study or the article.
Sure.
But the other thing that was problematic about it is we partnered with SurveyMonkey, maybe?
Sure. That's what I use. I use SurveyMonkey.
Yeah, I mean, I use it.
Yeah.
But we did it in a way that was like, you know, normally when I do like SurveyMonkey or whatever, it's like I have the pool of people that I am going to send the survey to. Whereas we used their service to where they said, okay, we have a community of survey takers who get some kind of incentive to like take surveys.
Okay.
Maybe we pay them a quarter or something per survey, something like that. So they were like, we'll use that survey base. And until when you get 1,000 responses, we'll send you the results. And my editor and my co-author were like, yeah, that's great. And I was like, hold on a second. All we're getting, because it's a company that makes a living on having this base of survey takers, they were not able to tell us who these people were.
Right.
So it's like, we are trying to make claims about like what men in America think about being men. And it's like, are we getting only, who's taking these surveys? Probably someone who's 22 and in college, or like
a
bot farm in Russia.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, I bet this is not a representative sample of men in America. And I bet they're taking the survey in a blazing hurry because they're trying to like generate whatever income or whatever they get from it.
Yeah.
And maybe if SurveyMonkey was able to tell us, well, it's, you know, 80% of the population is between 20 and 29. They're mostly urban. They're mostly college educated. Then we could at least use that information to adjust our inferences to say probably it's the case that people are overestimating. We're probably looking at a more liberal population or not or what, da, da, da. But they wouldn't tell us. And so I was just like, I say this to my students all the time. Like, if you don't know how the data was collected, do not use that data. That's the only data you should never, ever use.
That data is useless.
Yeah.
You might as well.
I agree.
Light $300 on fire.
Yeah.
That is amazing. Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, you can look up the article if you want.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's
fascinating and horrible.
It's not good.
Yeah.
Fascinating and horrible. Yeah. So there's a data anecdote for you where it's just like, I was like, oh, this is all shit all the way. I keep thinking I'm going to get in trouble, but I haven't worked there for years. And they stopped paying me on holidays.
So. Right, right. So now, and you still have that laptop, but probably not because you've had to move on to a new laptop.
Actually, yeah, it has since died.
Yeah. So sad, too bad. I think that there's so much. It is some sort of blanket. They paint the world with the usefulness of data without a lot of the specifics that are needed to make it useful, I guess.
Right. They kind of, when I went to work there, I was very, it was like after I quit academia, one of my goals was to like get the cool stuff I was learning and teaching to my students, like out into the world. Because I was like, you know, being an NYU student is a very, very narrow fraction of the world's population. And there are particular, usually relatively well-off population. And so I was just like, forget this. So I was like, data journalism seems like where I want to go. And I was very excited to go there. And I was like, going to work, my vision of it was to work on like longer term projects that were more like research based, where we actually had hypotheses and ideas about the world and we tested them. And instead it was just like, quick, find a bunch of numbers about rebounds and make a histogram and put it out. And you're just like, but what is it telling us? Why are we doing this? Like, what's surprising or interesting? And it's even the name of it has since, in retrospect, I was so excited to work there, but they call themselves data-driven journalism.
Yeah.
And I have since come to decide that anything that's data-driven is no good. It's like ideas-driven, then explored with data.
Right.
Is what their tagline should be. Well, it's not, because that's not what they're doing. They are doing data-driven journalism.
I have a hippie crystal-related story to go with that. I once read a romance novel that all kinds of, lot of dorkdoms all over this guy. It's and here it is. It's rose quartz is supposedly the crystal of love, right? It should, it's emotion.
I like it.
Amethyst is the crystal of intelligence. And I don't know what this rock is made out of, but it's like ammonite or something like that. I can't remember exactly, but it was given to me by someone who loves rocks. That's their dorkdom. They're big rock dorks. And I was told in this romance novel that love and emotion and should drive intelligence to success. And it makes, because a lot of people, intelligence drives their emotions towards something, towards some sort of thing. But if you let your heart draw push what you know, then it won't push you in the wrong direction. And whatever happens at the end of it, something nice. You get whatever.
That's an equation with rocks for a happy life. You did it. That's awesome.
Hello and welcome to Rock Talk. There we go. And
that's awesome.
Sally,
well, this makes me
okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. This makes me think of something that I think is very interesting, which is in political science, for a long time, we copied The Economist, where we said humans are rational actors, or they try to be rational, but they have limited information, so maybe they make mistakes sometimes. But generally, we like think as calculators, and we do what I tried to do when I was like, should I quit my job? Math can tell me. And that's how we make our decisions. Last couple of decades, political scientists said, you know what might play a role in politics? Emotion. Maybe we should pay attention to emotion. And so then the framework, I'm oversimplifying, but the framework was, okay, emotion is a drag on our intelligence. So if I think this policy is right, but I'm emotionally wedded to it, I might not change my views as much. And it was, and it's literally only in the last few years, I think, that we've been like, what if it's emotion first and then reasoning about politics? And you beat them all to it with your rocks.
Right. It turns out Elizabeth Lowell wrote about it in a romance novel in the 90s.
Yeah.
Anyway.
You should have read that, because we were just like, no, literally emotions were like an asterisk that made us worse decision makers. And that was just, and you know what? It was a lot of straight white dudes who were writing the political science at that time.
Right. And they had emotions and they had, and there's all this sort of entitlement and privilege and all of these things that make us unaware of what's happening in other people's lives and other people's worlds, which is still something I'm learning. You know, I mean, I'm sitting middle-aged white lady over here, sitting in a gravy boat. And so I have my own onion that needs to be more to be revealed so that I notice that other people are also alive and have the same hopes and dreams and everybody's a person. So,
Even people who like guns, to be very, like,
They're
struggling,
just,
you know, and hate abortion and all the rest. Again, not to assume your politics, but, like, I have to remind myself.
Always funny about my politics. When my dad said to me several years ago, he's like, you ever get in trouble? Anybody ever want to get mad at you about your politics? And recently, yes. But for the most part, no. Because people look at me and they're like, what's she going to do? Vote? I'm terrified. Anyway, and so, and my stuff is
sign an online petition, maybe, if you had a couple. Yeah.
Right. I'm going to send $100 to something. And
to like a very mainstream candidate. like the, you know,
I
donated to Obama. That was what's going on with me in my life.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but it was, I mean, and people assume that it's that. And then there's the other bit I do is about how everybody's just a sausage casing. And and then we're all just a stack of meat with a brain on top. And if we could meet the stack of meat with the brain on top first, and then play Mary fuck kill, it would simplify, you know, it would level the playing field.
Yeah.
And even sexually, you might get into some sort of sexy times because you really like the stack of meat with a brain on top, even though usually I'm attracted to sausage casings. So, but the, you know, but, and it's not that I don't want people to celebrate their sausage casings. Please do.
Right.
You got that thing that hangs off of it. It's a certain shade. Do whatever you need to do. But but meat first and brain first.
Now I'm just like, we're sauteing sausages in onions and it's all very fragrant.
As I always like to say, please do not use this for cannibalism. The sausage analogy.
Noted.
Yes, please.
Yes.
There you go.
Yes.
And, but I've weeded off and it's good. What about something that you think that a data science that's worked that you think was really very helpful, or that was successfully gave some information that you were or at least excited that you were to to do the study.
Right. Right. Well, I'd like the happiness data I've been talking about, it sounds a little banal, but it's like, honestly, most data we collect is about miserable stuff because understandably we hope to fix problems.
Yep.
But you can go to literally worldhappiness.report.
Okay.
And you can look at the summaries of their studies, and like, for all my complaining about their ladder setup, I think they've done as good a job as you can on something as abstract as this. And it's really interesting to look at things like, they did a big special about COVID, and they've done, I do some stuff with my students where we track the U.S. happiness over time, and it's like 2016, things go down, and you're like, I wonder what's going on there. So it's an interesting place, and it's relatively accessible, and you can download the data. So I like that. Otherwise, I mean, there's one of my favorite things in data science, very hard to pull off, but when you can, is anytime someone manages to do a natural experiment, which is like a treatment and control situation, like you might imagine for like a drug trial, but it's in the real world with what we call observational data, which is most of the data we have, which is like, did the economy go up? Well, let's write down those numbers and find out. Is oil production going down? Write down those, like, observation. We're not doing a study. And one of my favorite ones, stop me if this is like way too long, but one of my favorite studies is a study I saw years ago about air pollution and its impacts on human health. So we all have the idea that air pollution is bad for our health, like,
yeah.
Wild hypothesis, right? But how do you actually test that? Because you can't put people in a room and have car exhaust pumped in for 2 weeks until it happens, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can, and I think we have in history, but you should.
But all of those people have been certainly vilified, and,
exactly.
And correctly so, yes.
Right, yeah. Right. Their research has been heavily redacted, and we're all glad for it. Like, not in the Journal of the Annals of Medicine or whatever. So what do you do? Well, you look at observational data that says, well, there's more lung problems in places with higher pollution, and you're kind of like, okay, that's probably informative, but correlation is not causation. Is there something else we can do? These researchers did this study. So in Beijing, they're in China, they have one of those policies. I think London has it, other cities have it, where if your car license plate ends in an odd number, you can go into the city center with no fee or whatever on certain days. And every other day, cars with even license plates can go in, right?
Oh, interesting.
We have, those okay. are everywhere. It so happens that in China, there is a big superstition around the number 8. So everyone loves the number 8. 8 is considered very auspicious. I lived in China for a few years, and even I still think about it. I'm like, ooh, there's an 8 in that address. What an auspicious place to live. You know, that must, people will pay extra for phone numbers with 8s in it, with addresses, all this stuff.
Oh, interesting.
So people go out of their way to get license plates that end in the number 8.
Okay.
So that means that every other day when the evens drive into the city, there's way more traffic and way more cars. And so what happened is Beijing inadvertently created an experiment where every other day, the entire city is subject to a treatment of way more air pollution, like twice as much exhaust from cars.
Right.
And so then the researchers were able to take the data from people calling into the hospital on even days and odd days, and there were way more calls to the hospital on even days when there were way more cars. So you can almost get at like causality.
Yeah.
And say, wow, this traffic is causing people to go to the hospital with respiratory problems. Never mind. I mean, we're not talking long-term stuff. It's an imperfect study. But isn't that genius? That's
yes.
how you use data, right?
Yeah.
Oof, I got chills just thinking about it. That's how you fucking do it.
That is an amazing dorkdom. By the way,
I need a cigarette. Yeah.
Everyone should know that I'm talking to Andrea Jones-Roy, and it's at Jones-Roy, J-O-N-E-S. Roy is spelled R-O-O-Y, and jonesroy.com. Her podcast is called Majoring in Everything, and she's a stand-up comic and a data scientist analysis, and we're talking about it, and we're doing good work. What? That's a great example of
oh,
how
right.
it just happened.
I didn't
happened.
Know if it was too involved, but it's,
oh, no, no,
it's one of my favorites.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah. The challenge, yeah, when the minutiae is coming in hot, so appreciate the opportunity to talk about it.
Right, if you got another one, I'd love to hear it, because that was actually fascinating. Because I do wonder, do a lot of cities do that even odd thing where they try to regulate traffic that way?
Some. I don't know a ton about, like, you know, it's like a climate change / congestion thing. And I think New York has done the version, we're constantly debating it, should there be like a congestion tax? I think there is a congestion tax, you know, you pay more to get into the city and all that kind of stuff. But I think London, I think a handful of other cities have the, like, you know, certain days you can drive in. And basically the idea is to nudge people, I think, towards public transportation. That said, all of this was before COVID, so I don't know how much the, like, hybrid work thing has meddled with any of that.
Oh, right. I do remember that when we went into lockdown here in Los Angeles. And when China went into lockdown,
that
affected air quality across the planet.
Yes.
And that was
so good for the planet.
Right, right. I'm sure the planet was like, that's why I created this virus. You people would stop it.
And it's like, I'm going to pour bleach on the whole exercise because I need to like chill everything out.
Right. You're killing me. So we're going to kill a bunch of you to try to slow down this just essentially, sometimes I think of the virus as the Earth's antibodies. And then we are the parasite and they are fighting. The Earth is fighting as hard as it can. It's just a life. It's just an organism, right?
Yeah.
The planet.
Monkeypox, all the rest. The fires.
Right.
Yeah.
The fires, the tornadoes, everything is just like, are there really 8 billion of that one thing?
We are a horrible virus. I think that when I walk around, I'm just like, we've just smothered a beautiful planet with concrete. How disgusting.
Right, right.
It's like psoriasis on the Earth.
And any number of comics have done this joke, which is the planet will be fine. The planet will kill us and it will continue to exist. It was a George
volcanoes.
Right.
It
was a George Carlin bit. It was a Dennis Miller bit before he went off the deep end. It was, a couple of great, those were the two that I remember who did jokes like that. So they were good ones. Yeah.
I think even, before all the stuff went down, Louis C.K. had a joke in that direction where he was like, why did you have to create jobs and an economy and roads? Like, I gave you fruit and chocolate and grass. Like, why?
Right.
Why'd you do all that?
Right,
just to get more food. Anyway, but enough. He's had enough.
I'm just waiting for the deal where my next iPhone has his special on it and I can't delete it. It would be ironic. Anyway.
One more thing for me to worry about now. I saw him on the street the other day. I tried to sell him a comedy ticket. He wasn't interested.
Were you barking?
Mm-hmm. That's the kind of level I'm at.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Everybody fucking, her Venmo is Jones Roy. okay. So. Yeah, I have to say that, so what are your favorite kinds of spreadsheets? When in presentation, do you like a pie graph? I don't know. I'm reaching at this point.
Well, you struck a nerve because I have very strong opinions about a pie graph.
Oh, do you?
I do, which is they should never be used. Possibly even when you're talking about amounts of pie that's left. They're worthless graph and I hate them.
Oh my God.
Don't even talk to me. You're insulting my whole family by bringing up a pie graph. That part's not true, but I don't like them. They're terrible. Even worse than a pie graph is those ring graphs, where at least in the pie graph, you have the middle filled out and you kind of can see the triangle angles. You can kind of see the difference. But sometimes it's just like an inner tube.
Yep.
And they just fill in and you're just like,
with colors.
I can't tell what this is. Why is this a thing? Yeah.
Right.
It can always be a bar chart.
Your bar chart?
Pie graph.
Okay. So your favorite is a bar chart?
I like a histogram, I would say.
Okay.
Like
what does a histogram look like? What does a histogram look like?
A histogram is a bar chart for a continuous variable. So what that means is it's anytime you look at something that's like, here's the distribution of like human heights. And it kind of is like that normal distribution. Like people call it the bell curve. I use it in heavy quotes because that term has been very, very dangerously misused. And so we don't like it. But that's like the idea.
Okay.
And so it tells you, or you could have something that's like a bimodal distribution, which means you have a lot of people who have like a low value and then nothing in the middle. And then a lot of people who have a high value. So overall, I like to look at the distribution of a variable. There it is. Yes.
Okay. So it's different than a bar graph.
Right.
Okay. But it looks like a bar graph.
Right. The main difference is that the bars are all touching each other in a histogram, or usually, depending on how you've done
it. Oh, interesting. Interesting. Yeah, they are.
Whereas a bar chart, you'll use it for like a categorical variable. So if you were like, what is your job? Comedian, hot dog manager, etc. Like that would be a bar chart.
Right. Look, so
there you go.
Histogram
you
versus
go.
Bar chart.
Yes.
There is it's okay.
This show imagery is finding itself, you know?
Yeah, this
people are in for a treat. Yeah,
people, you really are. You got to watch this one on the YouTubes, you guys.
Yeah,
you got to check
very visual.
It's a visual one where we're looking at rocks, we're looking at charts.
Yeah,
What I do need though is is how, and you probably just explained it, how the histogram, like this, let me pull one up. It is, this is a distribution of salaries of the employees of the ABC Corporation. The up,
fascinating,
right? The number, right? The number of employees and mm-hmm. the salary in thousands. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So between 500 and 600 of, oh, this is ABC Corporation is an example. This is an example histogram. This is not actually ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.
So much for our insights.
I know.
You know?
Quite honestly, it wasn't even that interesting.
Let's think of a spicy example to grab their attention. Like, I know, salaries of ABC Corporation employees. Right.
Well, remember there was at one point, and I think Ben and Jerry sold their company, but they used to have a rule that nobody could be paid more than 100 times more than the person who made the lowest amount of money.
I like that.
So if the janitor was making 10 bucks an hour, no one could make more than 100 grand an hour. Or something, nice. Or whatever the actual math would be on that, which it might be that.
Well, and if you look at salary data, actually, it's typically not, depends on the area and what you're looking at, but if you look at like salary data in the United States or wealth data, it's what we would call power law distributed usually. And what that means is it's sort of like a long tail. So a lot of people make not that much money up to, you know, definitely most people make less than 100,000 in the United States per year. But then you have the Musks and the Bezos and the Gates and all the rest who create this really, 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 really long tail where they make a fortune every year.
Right.
And so it sounds like what Ben and Jerry's was doing was saying, like, we don't like this shape of inequality, so let's artificially jam it together, which I think is actually cool.
Right. And I think it it because it just meant that they were if they wanted to make a lot of money, they had to pay more money at the lowest level. So if that guy is now making 25 bucks an hour, they can then make 250 grand an hour.
Yeah.
And that isn't going to cost them that much money.
Yeah.
So it's actually an excellent, I think an excellent example of how to pay, do a pay scale.
And you think about it, I'm not an economist and certainly not like a labor wage economist, but I have my political and personal opinions about the Great Recession and all that kind of stuff. And it's kind of like, yeah, well, we're all sick of working super hard for no money. So how about you give us more money and we'll show up.
Right, right. And inflation comes from the fact that with 16 months of people actually not working and making an okay living while getting enough sleep was probably like, will change society, you know?
Yeah.
Because it people are like, well, I don't think I can work 60 hours a week again.
Yeah.
And justify it when I now am able to spend time with my kids. And a lot of people who spent time with their kids were like, it's too much time with my kids. But
I can't wait to go back to the office.
Right.
Yeah.
But as my stepmother always said, what you're getting from me is quantity time. And from quantity time comes quality time.
That's
so
nice.
She's like, we can't afford quality time. So what you're going to get is quantity time. And hidden within there is going to be some nuggets. You're going to love it.
It's kind of like the Value City TJ Maxx model where you're like, you find some real gems. You just got to sift through all the rest, you know?
Ooh, good point. Good point. We are
Value City parenting.
Exactly. I don't mind that. So we are pushing an hour. Thank you so much for being on the program, Andrea.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. And everybody, it's, of course, Majoring in Everything is the name of your podcast. And it's at Jones Roy, JonesRoy, and JonesRoy.com is the website. Stand-up comedy in New York City. So find her. And see that and listen to the podcast. This has been fascinating and it's something I've never cared about. So this is one of my favorite things about the Dork Forest.
It's such a good idea for a show just to like,
what do you
your line about like, no such thing as too much minutiae. And I was like, wow, amazing. Yeah.
Right. Whatever we're talking about. If it's Paddington 2, I need to know frame by frame what you loved about it. So thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me and letting me talk about this stuff. Normally, it's my students who hate me for talking about it, so I appreciate it.
And Rangers, you know the rules out there. Take care of each other.
My hat, my hat, my hat. They're dancing around my hat, my hat, my hat, my hat. Well, what do you think of that? If it looks like a Mexican hat dance and it sounds like a Mexican hat dance, it's most likely a Mexican hat dance. So take off your hat and let's dance.
Yay! Oh, my God. Why don't we just call that as the end of the show?